This is volume 3, and it's the first segment. We begin with November the 1st, 1899, the purification of the church. Louisa says, as I was in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself inside a church in which there was a priest celebrating the divine sacrifice. And while doing this, he was crying bitterly and said, "The pillar of my church has no place to lean." Now, I don't know if you remember, back in the 12th century, the church had a crisis, and the Pope at the time had a vision of a little man, literally tiny, putting his shoulder to the church. And some months later, when he met Francis of Assisi and his first companions, he recognized him as the small man that he had seen. In the act in which Jesus was saying this, Louisa said, "I saw a pillar. Its top touched the heavens, and the bottom of this pillar, at the bottom of it, there were priests, bishops, cardinals, and all the other dignities, sustaining the pillar. To my surprise, I went about looking, and I saw that of all these people, some were weak, some were half rotten, some were infirm, and some full of mud." Now, that's a spiritual diagnosis, okay? They were not like this on the outside. They were like this on the inside. And of course, we're living at the stage where this has actually happened. So very scarce was the number of those who were in a condition in which they could sustain it. So this poor pillar kept swaying, unable to remain still. So many were the quakes it received from the bottom, because all the people at the bottom were in trouble. At the top of this pillar, there was the Holy Father. Now, in 1899, the Holy Father was Leo XIII. And you remember the great vision that Leo XIII got after Mass, in which he witnessed a dialogue between Jesus and Satan. And Satan asked for 100 years to destroy the church. And amazingly, he got permission. Of course, he didn't get permission to destroy the church, but to test it, to sift it like wheat. Do you remember before the Passion that Jesus said to Peter, "Peter, all of you will be sifted like wheat." And it happened during the terrible Passion of Jesus. So at the top of this pillar, there was the Holy Father, who with gold chains and with rays emanating from his whole person, did as much as he could to sustain it. Now, that means that rays coming from his whole person means he's truly in grace. And to chain and illuminate the people who dwelled at the bottom, the Holy Father did as much as he could. Although some of them would flee so as to be more comfortable in being rotten and covered with mud. Now, in 1899, they atheistic materialism that had been launched on the world through the French Revolution had really taken hold. And it was about to spill out over the whole world in the 20th century and make 20th century what Jesus himself calls the most evil and violent of all centuries. So let me just read that little bit again. The Holy Father did as much as he could to stop people at the bottom from doing bad and to illuminate them, that is, with his teachings and his prayers and everything. But they ran away from him in order to enjoy becoming rotten and to enjoy being covered with mud. In other words, they enjoyed the heresies they were going into. And not only this, but he did as much as he could to bind and to illuminate the whole world. Now, bind is to bind them to the truth. To illuminate is to teach them properly. So in other words, to put this very, very simply, she saw a crisis in the clergy and the hierarchy. We're in the depths of that crisis now. While I was seeing this, that priest who was celebrating Mass, I'm not sure whether he was a priest or the Lord, Louisa said, "it seems to me that it was Jesus, but I cannot tell with certainty. He called me close to himself and he said, 'My daughter.'" Now, if she's addressed as my daughter, it was definitely Jesus. "See in what heart-rending state my church is." Now, in these writings, Louisa usually sees that when she sees Jesus in a terrible state during his passion, because he's now in glory, of course, and he's not suffering, but his mystical body on earth is suffering. And so when he would want her to appreciate what was going on in the church, she would see him in some aspect of being crucified. So he says, "In what a heart-rending state my church is. The very ones who were supposed to sustain her withdraw, and with their works they knock her down, they beat her, and they reach the point of even denigrating her." That means they've gone off into this atheistic Marxism and materialism and modernism and all the stuff Pope Pius X, a few years after this, actually condemned. "The only remedy is that I cause so much blood to be shed, that's the blood of martyrs usually, as to form a bath to wash away that rotten mud and to heal their deep wounds. Now, what he's saying here is something you already know, and that is that the blood of the martyrs actually cleanses the church, just as his blood brought about not only the cleansing of the world, but brought about redemption itself. So the martyrs then participate in a very deep way in redemption. He said, so I cause so much blood to be shed as to form a bath to wash away that rotten mud and to heal their deep wounds, so that, healed, strengthened and embellished in that blood, they may become instruments capable of keeping the church stable and firm. Then he added, I have called you to tell you, do you want to be a victim soul? Now, my book simply says a victim, but in our day and age, you cannot leave that word by itself. It'll be misunderstood. Do you want to be a victim soul and therefore be like a prop to sustain this pillar in these times so incorrigible? So he is calling Louisa to accept the role of being a victim soul, and therefore she would stand between the justice of God and the sinfulness of man, holding back some of the justice of God in order to have as many people as possible saved. Like all of the mystics, she won't succeed completely, but she will succeed somewhat. And this is the story that we're going to be dealing with as we go through all of these volumes. So Louisa said, at first a shiver ran through me for fear that I might not have the strength, but then immediately I offered myself and I pronounced the fiat. Now beside that, I want you to put John 15:5, without me, Jesus says, you can do nothing. So you can definitely say yes to this, because it won't be yourself, it'll be the Lord. So with that, I want to give you Philippians 4:13. But I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength, which is a different matter altogether. So Louisa said her yes, her fiat. At that moment, I found myself surrounded by many saints, angels and purging souls. That's the souls in purgatory, who tormented me with scourges and other instruments. In other words, immediately began to give her the experience of making reparation for the church. At first, I felt a certain fear. And then the more I suffered, the more I wanted to suffer. And I enjoyed the suffering like a most sweet nectar, more so since a thought touched me. Now, when she says that she enjoyed the suffering, no human being enjoys suffering. So you've got to put Hebrews 12:2 beside that. Now, Hebrews 12:2 says that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame of it. So you endure the suffering. And the reason why you're happy to endure the suffering is that you appreciate what it's doing. In other words, as we go through these volumes, you will realize that suffering voluntarily for love of God has an enormous value in the eyes of God. And he calls it divine currency. And it's with this divine currency that you can, if I can use the word buy with inverted commas, you can buy souls. In other words, you can pay part of their redemption. Or you can participate in Jesus' redemption, because Jesus said, I am the vine and you are my branches. So if he's the redeemer, then we are to be co-redeemers, because we're branches of that vine. And that's why he calls us into this wonderful mission of the divine will. It's definitely not a devotion. It's a mission in which we enter into being co-redeemers with Christ to the depths that you want to go to. The Lord will never push you. So she said she felt a fear first, and then she was happy. And then the thought came to her, who knows whether these pains might be the means to consume my life so that I might take wing in the last flight towards my only good. Now, one of the totally extraordinary things about Louisa is her extraordinary desire to go to heaven. Now, it's not a desire to die as such. In other words, I want to get rid of this earth. I want to get rid of this body. That's the way suicides think. That's not Louisa's situation. Louisa wants to die because she has seen the Lord. She has seen heaven, and she will see it an awful lot more as we go along in the volumes as well. And the more she gets to know the Lord and the more she loves him, the more she wants to go and be with the Lord. So for that, I want to give you 2 Corinthians 5 verses 1 to 10, where St. Paul also says that he would like to throw off the veil of the flesh and go to the Lord, but he would stay on the earth to fulfill his mission out of love for God. And that's exactly what the Lord asks Louisa to do. So But to my highest sorrow, Louisa said, after suffering bitter pains, I saw that these pains would not consume my life and that this fragile flesh prevents me from uniting myself to the eternal good. So she began to realise rather quickly that she could suffer all of this agony, but it was not going to take her life because that wasn't God's will. For her, God's will was that she would suffer on the earth as he suffered on the earth to save souls on the earth as he did. So Louisa said, after this, I saw the bloody slaughter that was made of the people who were at the bottom of the pillar. What a horrible catastrophe. Now, once the Lord gives information to his saints or to his prophets, I want to give you Amos 3:7. The Lord never does anything without telling the saints first, without telling the prophets. That's what they call the saints in the Old Testament. And here Louisa sees a terrible slaughter. Now, from about 2017, I think we had the terrible Soviet Union catastrophe starting with the Bolshevik Revolution, and that literally millions of people died as a result of that. And communism had a terrible victory there, and the church received the most dreadful persecution there. So it could be that. But Our Lady in Fatima comes, you know, 2017, and she tells us that if we don't repent, there will be a terrible slaughter. Now, before both of those events that I've just said, you have the First World War, 1914 to 1918. So she's seeing ahead of time the terrible war. Now, you know that the First World War was called the war to end all wars, but it ended nothing. We had an even worse one, 1939 to 45. And there is a Third World War being cooked up at the moment as well, which will be even infinitely worse, partly because the instruments they have devised for killing are much more technical and they're much more efficient. So you don't even have to send an army anymore. You can send a missile across the world and you can send it and destroy a whole nation absolutely without them knowing what is coming. So Louisa said, so very scarce was the number of those who would not be victims. That is in this terrible catastrophe. They reached such daringness as to try and kill the Holy Father as well. Well, that's true. They made a prisoner in the Vatican of the Holy Father as well. But then it seemed to me that blood which was shed and those bloody tormented victims were the means to render those who remained strong so as to sustain the pillar without letting it sway anymore. So the people who survived these terrible wars were the ones whose faith was renewed and who supported the church. After this, she said, days of triumphs and of peace would arise. And of course, we've had a so-called peace since the Second World War. Not really, because there's been wars all over the place, but they call it peace anyway. But this is not the triumph of the Immaculate Heart that our Mother, Blessed Mother, spoke about. And it's not the triumph of the Sacred Heart that Jesus spoke about. That is still to come. So there will be days of triumphs and of peace will arise. The face of the earth seemed to be renewed and the pillar would acquire its original prestige and splendour. Now, this is very early in Louisa's work, but we now know that after the Third World War, the terrible chastisement that's coming, there will be the new era of the new and divine holiness, which the Lord will ask Louisa to actually open the door for this to happen. And there will be a period of most wonderful grace and peace on the earth before the final onslaught of Satan. O happy days, she said, I hail you from afar, days which will give great glory to my church and great honour to the God who is her head. So Louisa is seeing something in the far distant future, even for you and me. So November the 3rd, 1899, Jesus enjoys himself with Louisa. Now, my book uses the word amusement or amuses. Now, we don't use that language, so I want to change it to enjoys, which we do use. In other words, people who love each other play little love games with each other. So this morning, my beloved Jesus came and transported me outside of myself inside a church. And then he disappeared and I was left alone. Now, finding myself in the presence of the Most Blessed Sacrament, I did my usual adoration. But while I was doing this, it seemed to have become all eyes to see whether I would catch the sight of Jesus. At that moment, I saw him on the altar as a child calling me with his gracious little hand. Who could say my contentment? I flew to him, she said, without thinking of anything else. I clasped him in my arms and I kissed him. But in the act in which I was doing this, he assumed a serious appearance, showing that he did not like my kisses. and he began to reject me. Heedless of this, I continued, and I said to him, "My pretty little one, beautiful one, the other day you wanted to pour yourself out with me with kisses and with hugs, and I gave you all the freedom. Today I too want to pour myself out with you." This is the tit for tat of the love games. "Oh, please give me the freedom to do it." But he continued to reject me. And in seeing that I wouldn't stop, he disappeared. Who can say how mortified and concerned I was left when I found myself inside of myself? However, after a little while, he came back. And as I wanted to ask him for forgiveness for what my book calls impertinences. Now, impertinences cannot be the correct translation because impertinence is sinful. It's sinful behavior. So I want you to change that word to boldness because she said she was daring up above. Okay. I wanted to ask him forgiveness for my boldness. He forgave me by wanting to pour himself out with me. And while kissing me, he said, "Beloved of my heart, my divinity resides in you habitually." Now, the Blessed Trinity was given to us in baptism to abide in us, but it only stays with us when we're in grace. 1 Corinthians 3:16, "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that God dwells in you?" So when Jesus says that my divinity resides in you habitually, he's speaking about the level of grace that she has. Because in volume 2, we were told that Jesus said, "I am grace." Grace is an outpouring of God himself. So if we have this outpouring of God in us, naturally, he will find it easy to stay with us. So, beloved of my heart, my divinity resides in you habitually. And just as you keep inventing new things to make me delight with you, so I give you tit for tat. Because, see, these are love games. I use new ways to make you delight with me. With this, I understood that it had been a joke, my book says. God never jokes with us. It had been a game that Jesus wanted to play. Because, you see, he came to her as a child and children play. So November the 4th, 1899, I have a VIP on this one. The different effects of the presence of Jesus and that of the devil. So this is a very important message of discernment. So it's good to write discernment at the top of the page. There's lots of passages that give us helps with discernment. Since this morning, Blessed Jesus was not coming. The devil was trying to assume his shape. Now, the devil is so arrogant that he will even pretend that he is God. He will even pretend to be a saint or an angel or anything. It doesn't matter to him so long as he deceives you and gets you to do the wrong thing. And to make himself seen, just remember now, in the book of Revelation, it's in chapter 6, I think it is, you have the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And the first one is described as a rider on a white horse riding to victory. Well, if you go to chapter 19, that is the description of Jesus returning in glory. So the first one is deception. Someone pretending to be who he isn't. Okay? And here's the devil pretending to be Christ and trying to assume the effect of Christ. That's the way the Antichrist will behave. He will try and tell us he's the real thing and that he's the one that is going to save the world and that we have to worship him because after all, he is the Son of God. In fact, he will be the son of Satan. So the devil was trying to assume Jesus' shape and to make himself seen. But since I didn't perceive the usual effects, now that's where you put a big NB beside that, okay? And that's where you get your colouring pencil and you actually either underline it or colour it right through. I didn't see the usual effects. So I began to doubt and I signed myself with the cross. Now, this is very, very important. If you sign yourself reverently with the cross, the demon can't stay. I signed myself with the cross, first myself and then him. Now, throughout these writings, especially in the early volumes where Louisa is discerning all the time that the person who's communicating with her is in fact Jesus. And she often even signs Jesus with the signs of the cross and he just smiles. Watch here. So she said, "I signed myself with the sign of the cross and then him. And the devil, in seeing himself signed, began trembling." That's very, very interesting. "Immediately I rejected him without even looking at him." Okay. "After a little while," she said, "my dear Jesus came, and fearing that it might be the evil spirit once again, I tried to reject him, invoking the help of Jesus and the Queen Mother. But to assure me that it was not the devil, he said, 'My daughter.'" You see, the devil will never call you my daughter. in order to be assured as to whether it is I or not, your attention must be on the interior effects. Satan can never give you peace. Satan can never give you humility. And Jesus tells us in these writings to plunge into our nothingness, the safe place, and stay there. Satan can't get near you in that nothingness. So if you stay in humility and in total trust in the Lord, Satan can't get at you. It's actually that simple. But if he does manage to get your attention, you will have disturbance and you will feel, oh, there's something not right here. So Jesus said to her, your attention must be on the interior effects of whether the move is towards virtue or towards vice. In fact, since my nature is virtue, I make my children heirs of nothing else but virtue. In other words, if you're really dealing with God, you will be growing in holiness. You can also understand this from human nature, which is made of flesh. If it happens to develop some wounds, the flesh becomes rotten and one can say it's no longer flesh. In the same way, if my nature could retain even the slightest shadow of vice within itself, it would cease to be the God that it is. Okay, I want to give you Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. I also want to give you Habakkuk 1:13. And that is, Lord, your eyes are too holy to look upon evil. So now we go on to November the 6th, 1899. This morning, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus came and transported me outside of myself. He showed me streets full of human flesh. So here again, we're into prophecy, Amos 3:7. You also have Isaiah 46:10. And it's about giving the Lord giving prophecy. She said, he showed me streets full of human flesh. What a ruthless slaughter. It is horrifying to think about it. And then he showed me how something was happening in the air and many would die suddenly. Now, don't forget, right at the side, the atomic bomb, 1945. She saw it, but didn't have the language to describe it. And of course, millions of people died within seconds of the atomic bomb. I've also seen this since the month of March, she said. Now, if she's looking at the atomic bomb, then she's looking at the Second World War as well. She's getting a mixture of the two world wars, the horrendous slaughter of people. I began to pray him, according to my usual way, that he would placate himself and spare his very images torments so cruel and wars so bloody. Okay, so for images of the Lord, I want to give you Genesis 2:7. We were made in the image of God. And Romans 8:29, that we are reformed in the image of Jesus. So since Jesus had come with the crown of thorns, I removed it from his head, Louisa said, to place it on my own, and this in order to placate him more. She's extraordinarily courageous. I mean, how many people would dream of putting a crown of thorns on their own heads willingly? She's an incredible person. But to my highest sorrow, I saw that almost all the thorns would remain broken inside his most holy head, and so very little was left for me to suffer. Jesus appeared serious, almost without paying attention to me. He transported me again into my bed, and since I had my arms on the cross, suffering the pains of the crucifixion, which he himself had shared with me before, he took my arms and he united them together, binding them with a little rope of gold. Now, gold represents the Godhead. So whatever it is, it's divine. And you'll see this as we go along, that he binds her with the divine will. It's the gold of God. Not paying attention to what this might mean, Louisa said, in order to break that severe air that he had, I said to him, my most sweet love, I offer you these movements of my body that you yourself made me do, as well as all the others which I myself can do, for the sole purpose of pleasing you and glorifying you. This is extremely important. So I want you to put a heading at the top here, and that is the intention. Okay, we're going to come across the importance of the intention very, very often in these lower volumes, so that we're on our feet by the time he reveals the fullness of the divine will to us in volumes 11 and 12. So I want to give you John 8:29. I always do what pleases him. Jesus is speaking about his Father. Now, what he's looking for here is purity of intention. Now, we're doing something for a real purpose. And then when we say to Jesus, I do this for love of you, we actually mean it. We're not just saying words, okay? Or even worse, if I told somebody that I was going to fast tomorrow and in the back of my head I said, well, I could lose a few pounds as well. That's not purity of intention, and that fasting has no value. If you want to slim, slim. And if you want to fast, fast for love of God and to make reparation. So Louisa said, ah, yes, I wish that the movements of my eyelids, of my eyes, of my lips and all of myself were also made for the sole purpose of pleasing you alone. Let it be, O good Jesus, that all my bones and my nerves may resound among themselves and with clear voices may prove my love to you. Now here's Louisa asking that every single part of her actual body, let alone her soul and her mind and her spirit, is glorifying the Lord. Now there's an opportunity for us. And Jesus said to me, everything that is done for the sole purpose of pleasing me shines before me in such a way as to draw my divine gazes. And I like it so much that to these actions, be they even the batting of eyelashes, I give the value as if they were done by me. Now, the value as if they were done by me means that they become divine acts. Okay? Now, any of us can do this. All you've got to do is love him enough. On the other hand, those other actions, good in themselves and even great, but which are not done for me alone, there it is, the purity of intention, you see. St. Therese said that if you pick up a pin off the floor out of pure love for God, and you can't think of anything more innocuous than picking a pin off the floor. So she picks the smallest action you can think of. And she says, if you do it out of pure love for God, that action is worth all the projects that people are involved in on the planet. And the value of it is pure love of God. So if you want to sanctify your actions, here's a very simple way. I'm going to pick up that pin off the floor or that pen off the desk or whatever it is. And in itself, it has no value whatsoever. I'm going to give it value by saying to the Lord, I do this out of pure love for you alone. Now I can raise it a higher level by saying, Jesus, I want to unite this action with all the acts of love in your life so that I participate in all your actions of love at your level. And I want to do it in the divine will to make them divine acts. Therefore, this action of picking the pin off the floor or the biro off the desk, the pen off the desk, suddenly becomes a divine and infinite act, totally pleasing to God, and it will benefit all souls past, present and future. It's an awful shame not to do it. Okay? So he said, on the other hand, even if great actions are done, but not for love of Jesus alone, they are like gold that is muddy and full of rust, which doesn't shine. And she said, I don't even look at them. So I want to give you Matthew 7:21-23. Lord, did we not work mighty miracles in your name? Did we not prophesy in your name? And he said, I never knew you. Wow. That's frightening. So something completely innocuous can be of incredible value because of the divine love and divine will content. And if it's done just for ourselves or for worldly things, it has no value whatsoever. And Jesus said, one should not care about dust because it could be shaken off. But what one must take care about is the intention. So notice placing the intention is a huge thing in these writings, that you actually tell the Lord and yourself why you're doing something. Okay. Now, while we were saying this, Jesus was busy binding my arms. And I said to him, please, Lord, what are you doing? And he said, I'm doing this because when you are in the position of crucifixion, you come to placate me. And since I want to chastise the people, I'm binding them. And after that, he disappeared. Talk about playing love games. So the very reason why she would take on the crucifixion is to make reparation and to dampen down the chastisement if she can. And then he says, no, I'm not going to let it happen. But of course, he's not saying that what she's doing will have no effect. It'll have huge effect. As we go along in these volumes, he will tell her, I allow you 1/3. This is incredible that one person could mitigate a chastisement by 1/3. Just one. Can you imagine if we were all doing it? Our Blessed Mother in Medjugorje said you could stop wars and mitigate chastisements by prayer and fasting. So November the 10th, 1899, this is about obedience to the confessor, and obedience is one of the big subjects in Louisa's writings as well. After going through quite a few days of differences with Jesus, I wanting to be released and he not wanting it, he would make himself seen sleeping or he would impose silence on me. Finally, this morning, as I saw him, I also saw the confessor who commanded me absolutely to have Jesus release me. So she's getting an absolute obedience about this. And this more than once, but Jesus wouldn't listen. However, forced by obedience, I said to him, "My beloved Jesus, when have you ever opposed obedience? I am not the one who wants to be released. It is the confessor that wants you to make me suffer the crucifixion. Therefore, surrender to this virtue so favoured by you, which bejewels your entire life and which formed the last link by connecting everything into one, the sacrifice of the cross." Now, elsewhere, Jesus says that obedience was all over his life. And you get a whole summary of John's gospel through obedience. I only do what my Father tells me to do. I only say what my Father tells me to say. I only reveal what my Father tells me to reveal. The Father and I are one. And it goes on and on and on until it finally comes to John 14:31, which Jesus says, "I want the world to know that I love the Father and therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me." Okay. Jesus said to her, "Do you really want to use violence on me, touching that link, which is obedience, which connected divinity and humanity and formed one single link, which is obedience?" Now, with that, I want to give you Matthew 11:12. "The kingdom of God suffers violence and the valiant or the violent take it by force." So Louisa is doing the actions that actually put pressure on the Lord to hear her prayer. While saying this, he assumed the appearance of the crucified and almost forced by the priestly authority, he shared with me the pains of the crucifixion. May the Lord be always blessed and may everything be for his glory. So it seems I was released. Now, you've got something terribly important here, and that is that the authority given by Jesus to the priesthood in the church is real. So real that if the priest says, "Ego te absolvi," God absolves you from your sins. If the priest says, "This is my body and this is my blood," under the right conditions and properly ordained, then the Lord does in fact come and become Eucharist for us. That's just to give you two examples. If the priest says, "I baptize you in the name of the Father," you are baptized in the name of the Father, and that's it. That's the priestly authority. Now, what you find is that God acknowledges that priestly authority, regardless of whether the man who is the priest is worthy of that authority or not. This is something that has to be clarified in the age that you and I live in which the hierarchy and the clergy are in crisis. Their authority is to be respected. The individual person may or may not be worthy of that. Now, exorcists will also tell you that the demon recognizes priestly authority. There's a very wonderful example in the Acts of the Apostles where the sons of Sceva, seven sons of Sceva, were trying to cast out demons in the name of Jesus, whom Paul knows about. Now, they didn't believe in Jesus, but they knew that Paul was working incredible miracles. And so the demon says, "Who do you think you are? I know this Jesus and I know this Paul." And he attacked them and nearly destroyed them. Any of our exorcists, which of course has to be priests properly appointed by bishops to do an exorcism, I don't mean a deliverance now, I mean an exorcism. The demon will recognize the authority of the priest, but if somebody pretends to have that authority, the demon will just attack them. That's just a good lesson on priestly authority. So let's come to November the 11th, 1899. Obedience prevents her from conforming to justice. Obedience means she gets an order from the priest. "As I was in my usual state," Louisa said, "I found myself outside of myself and it seemed I was going around the earth. Oh, how inundated it was with all sorts of iniquities." It's horrifying to think about it. "Now, while going around, I arrived at some place where I found a priest of holy life. And in another place, a virgin of blameless and holy life. We gathered the three of us together and we began to converse about the many chastisements that the Lord was sending. and about the many others that he keeps prepared. And I said to them, and you, what do you do? Have you perhaps conformed to divine justice? And they said, seeing the strict necessity of these times, and that man would not surrender even if an apostle came out, or if the Lord sent another St. Vincent Ferrer, who might induce him to conversion with miracles and prodigious signs? On the contrary, seeing that man has reached such obstinacy and a sort of insanity, this is 1899, it's infinitely worse now, and a source of insanity, that the very power of miracles would render him more incredulous. Actually, we've arrived at the stage that working a miracle would be a waste of time. Isn't it really sad? So when Jesus worked miracles at the time of the incarnation, human beings were still at a level where if God touched them, they would acknowledge it. But we've gone so far down the road that we wouldn't acknowledge it, we being the human race, not you and I as individuals. So this is the Holy Priest and the Holy Virgin speaking to Louisa. So invested by this most strict necessity and for the good of men, that's the human race, in order to arrest this rotten sea that inundates the face of the earth, and for the glory of God, so offended, we have conformed to justice. In other words, we agree with what the Lord is doing. But we are praying and offering ourselves as victim souls so that these chastisements may turn out to be the conversion of the peoples. But you, what do you do? Have you conformed with us? And Louisa said, ah, no, I can't, because obedience doesn't want it. In other words, she's under strict obedience to the priest, even though Jesus wants me to conform. But since obedience does not want it, obedience must prevail over everything. Now, Jesus will tell Louisa that that is correct, that no matter whose opinion wants to change her, that whatever is told to her in obedience, that is what she has to do. So I am forced to be always in contrast with Jesus, she said, which afflicts me very much. And they said, oh, when it's obedience, surely one must adhere. So when the priest and the holy woman hears that indeed it is obedience that is ordering her, then they affirm for her, yes, you've got to obey. So after this, finding myself inside of myself, I saw my dearest Jesus for just a little, and I wanted to know where that priest and the virgin came from, and he told me they were from Peru. So the suggested identities are Rose of Lima and Martin de Porres. If you know better, you can tell the rest of us. November the 12th, 1899, Jesus allows Jesus to spare a chastisement, so she's going to be happy. This morning my beloved Jesus came and transported me outside of myself, and I saw as if something was supposed to move from the heavens to touch the earth. Now this is 1899, and in 1908 there was the meteor that struck Siberia, and obviously the victim souls were really interceding because it fell in a place where nobody was living, and therefore, while it did a lot of destruction, it didn't actually kill anybody. I was so frightened, she said, that I screamed, and I said to him, oh, please, Lord, what are you doing? How much ruin it will bring if this happens, which is she sees the meteor coming. And of course, a meteor can spell the end of an era, as it has done for the era of the dinosaurs and so on. So Louisa continues, how much ruin will come if this happens? You tell me that you love me, and then you want me to be so frightened. You have seen it, haven't you? No, don't do it. Don't. No, no. You can't do it because I don't want it. Now, there you have the victim soul telling the Lord, no, I don't want it. That meteor did not strike any town. It struck in an area that was very far from where anybody was living. But everything in the area was destroyed. No, no, she said, I don't want it. And Jesus, all compassion for me, told me, my daughter, don't fear. And then, when have you ever wanted me to do anything? He says to her, you know, you're always preventing me. He's only teasing her. I shouldn't let you see anything when I chastise people. Otherwise, you bind me everywhere. Well, then, I will fortify your heart, my book says. I will strengthen your heart with fortitude. Now, fortitude is the most wonderful gift of God. It's like the steel girders they put into the skyscrapers so that they can withstand even the hurricanes. So the hurricanes of the spiritual life can be handled with the gift of fortitude. I'll make as though a trunk rise from it, that's from your heart, so as to hold whatever you see still. And then I will pour so many graces on you that you'll be able to nourish myself and my children. Now, I want you to note that Jesus' word is creative. When he said, let there be light, there was light. When he said, let us make man in our own image and likeness, that's what happened. When Jesus speaks to us, he also creates the reality inside of us. For example, if I needed to forgive somebody, thank God I don't, but if I did, and Jesus said to me, forgive, he automatically gives me the grace and the courage to forgive. And so it's a very big sin if I don't do it. So at that moment, Louisa said, something like a trunk did come out of my heart with two branches at the top in the shape of a fork, which rising up into the air would catch it between them, anything that was about to move, in order to keep it still in one single place. And far away, it seemed to touch the earth. Afterwards, I found myself inside of myself and I prayed him to placate himself, and it seemed that he would quite surrender. So much so that he shared with me the pains of the cross. Now, what I'm going to say now is merely a suggestion. I am not claiming it is right. It looks as if that meteor was guided to a certain spot where it actually wouldn't do the damage it would have done. That meteor, if it hit any inhabited place, it would have killed millions in seconds. So you see the trunk of the tree and the two branches going up and making everything still and calm and guiding it down to the earth far away. Now, far away was the Siberian desert. OK, so she's seeing all of this in advance because the Lord gets the victim souls to pray in advance so that everything can be helped. If you're only praying at the time, it's too close to the event. So November the 13th, 1899, Jesus suffers in seeing us suffer, us being creatures. Louisa offers herself to console him. This morning, my adorable Jesus seemed to be restless. He'd do nothing but come and go. He'd spend time with me, and then, almost drawn by his most ardent love for creatures, he would go and see how they were doing, and with his whole self, he would suffer with them. Now, this is a big insight for Louisa, and she's going to use it. Why would he suffer with them? It's because divine will is inside of every creature, every plant, every tree, every animal of all levels and in each one of us. If the divine will wasn't there sustaining our creation, we would just simply disintegrate. So he would suffer with them from that which they were suffering, as if he himself and not they were taken by those sufferings. Several times I saw the confessor forcing Jesus by means of his priestly authority to make me suffer his pains so as to be able to placate him. And while it seemed that he didn't want to be placated, he would then show himself grateful, thanking wholeheartedly the one who was occupying himself with holding back his indignant arm. And so he would share with me one suffering and then another. Oh, how tender and moving it was to see Jesus in this state. He would make one's heart split with compassion. Quite a few times he told me, conform to my justice, for I can take no more. Man is too ungrateful, and he almost forces me from all sides to chastise him. Now, this is only volume 3, so I have to remind you where chastisement comes from. Sin goes up from the earth, but nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So sin is sent back to us in chastisement. In other words, we are our own worst enemies. And depending on what the sin is, the amount of that sin, the volume, the quantity of it will be the size of the chastisement. The victim soul moves in between that chastisement and God and asks the Lord and keeps pleading that the chastisement will be diminished in some way so that it becomes a lesson but not a judgment for us. So Jesus said, conform to my justice, because man is too ungrateful, and he almost forces me from all sides to chastise him. He himself snatches the chastisements from my hands, Jesus said. If you knew how much I suffer in making use of my justice, because he is mercy and love, that's his nature. But it is man himself who uses violence on me. Had I not done anything other than purchase his freedom at the price of my blood, he would still have to be grateful to me. But out of greater spite, he keeps inventing new ways to render my payment, that is redemption, useless. So it's unrequited love. It's a direct insult to Jesus as the Redeemer. It's flying in the face of God the Father, our Creator. And we expect to have no response to this. But while saying this, Jesus was crying bitterly. And to console him, I said to him, "My sweet good, do not afflict yourself. I see that your affliction is mostly because you feel forced to chastise the people. No, this will never be. If you are all for me, I want to be all for you." There's a big lesson for all of us. Notice the all. And that's Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, all your mind and all your being, and love your neighbor as yourself." So Louisa said, "If you are all for me, I want to be all for you. Therefore, you will send the chastisements upon me." See, that's what the victim soul does. He says, "I'll take the punishment," because that was what Jesus did on the cross. Instead of sending all of us to hell for our sins, he said, "No, give me the hell, I'll take it." And we'll give them forgiveness and new life. So it's unbelievably extraordinary. So Louisa said, "You send the chastisement upon me. Here is the victim. Always ready." Here's the victim's soul, we would have to say. "Here is the victim's soul, always ready at your disposal. You can make me suffer whatever you want. And so your justice will be somehow placated, and you will be relieved from the affliction you feel in seeing creatures suffer." Now, beside that, I want you to put Psalm 106, verse 23. The psalm said that if Moses hadn't stood in the breach between God's justice and the sins of the people would have been wiped out at the time of the Exodus. So Louisa continues, "My intention has always been this, not to conform to justice, because if man suffers, you suffer also, more than he does." That's like saying a parent never enjoys punishing a child. The parent feels miserable about it, and they feel the punishment more than the kid does. And so what Louisa is saying to Jesus is, "It's my love for you that doesn't want you to suffer anymore." So she's not saying that human beings are not bad. She's not saying they're not sinning. She's admitting all of this. But she's saying, "I don't want you to suffer." So while I was saying this, Louisa said, "Our Queen Mother came, and I remembered that I had asked the confessor for the obedience to conform to justice. That as I had asked the obedience to conform to justice, he had told me to ask the Most Holy Virgin whether she wanted me to conform. And so I asked her, and she said, 'No, no, but pray, my daughter, that in these days try as much as you can to keep him with you and to placate him, because many chastisements have been prepared.'" Now, put beside this John chapter 19, verses 26 to 27, because it was at the foot of the cross that Blessed Mother was constituted mother of all Christians, mother of all the redeemed. And she doesn't want her children chastised either. She wants more and more and more grace to be given to them. She doesn't want anybody to die in their sins. So let's go to November the 17th, 1899. Again, we have the priestly authority and we have the victim's soul. I'm doing this one as well because these messages follow on one from the other. "My beloved Jesus continues to make himself seen all afflicted. This morning, our Queen Mother came together with him." Now, don't forget that the Blessed Virgin Mary and Jesus were the only ones who lived on this earth with the divine will from conception to natural death. He by nature, because he was God, and she by grace. Okay, so here both of them are with her, and Louisa is entering into this wonderful journey of the divine will as well. "So they came together, and it seemed to me that she was bringing him to me so that I would placate him and pray to him together with her that he would make me suffer to spare the people." So I want to give you Isaiah 58 verse 12 there. Okay. "She told me that if in the past days I had not placed myself in between," that's standing in the breach, Psalm 106, verse 23, "and if the confessor had not used his priestly authority in concurring with his intentions to make me suffer, many catastrophes would have occurred." So Blessed Mother is telling her, "Your prayer is very powerful. You have already stopped many chastisements." "In the meantime," Louisa said, "I saw the confessor, and immediately I prayed for him to Jesus and to our Queen Mother. And Jesus all kindness. Now, my book says benignity, a word that we don't use anymore. All kindness said to me, according to the measure in which he will take care of my interests, by praying me and also by committing himself to renewing his intention in making you suffer in order to spare the people, so will I take care of him and I'll spare him. So Jesus says, if he wants me to do wonderful things for him, let him do his job of keeping you as a victim soul interceding for the people. He says, I'll be ready to make this pact with him. So after this, Louisa said, I went about looking at my sweet and only good, and I saw that he was holding two bolts of lightning in his hands, in one hand as though equipped. He had a strong earthquake and a war. And in the other, I don't know how you see a war in somebody's hand, but never mind, she saw some kind of an image. In the other one, many kinds of sudden deaths and contagious diseases. I began to pray him to pour these bolts of lightning upon me, and I almost wanted to remove them from his hands. But to prevent me from doing that, he began to move away from me. I tried to follow him, and so I found myself outside of myself, but Jesus disappeared from me, and I remained alone. Now, finding myself alone, I went round a little, and I found myself in a place where, in this season, they harvest. It seemed that the uproars of war were happening there, and I wanted to go and help these poor people, but the demons prevented me from going there where such things were about to happen, and they beat me so that I would not be able to help or to prevent their artifices. They used so much strength as to make me draw back. Now, Louisa gets a taste all for herself that this is a spiritual war that's going on in the heavenlies. And we on earth participate either by our choice for a holy life or our choice for a sinful life. We're either on God's side or on Satan's side. There is an interesting passage in the book of Daniel, chapter 10, verse 20, where Daniel had been praying and fasting for 3 weeks, I think it was. And he said, Lord, why am I getting no result? I can't do any more. And an angel appeared to him and told him, I think it was Michael the Archangel, yes, told him, I was opposed by the Prince of Persia. Now, the Prince of Persia, he means a demon. And he said, I had to fight him for the 21 days that you were fasting in order to be able to come and do what you ask. That's terribly important. I'm going to leave that there for now and we'll pick it up again.